Welcome to a special edition of the Marketplace Roundtable podcast featuring Jay Mintzmyer of Value Investor's Edge. Jay first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2011, building up a large following through his work covering shipping stocks, probably about as comprehensively as they're covered anywhere online or in print. Since 2015, Jay has run the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. The service offers intensive coverage of deep value opportunities in the shipping, energy, MLP, and industrial sectors. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. And now your host, Jay Mintzmyer.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Value Investor's Edge Live. We're hosting Star Bulk Carriers this morning, stock symbol SBLK. Several of their management team, Hamish Norton, the president of Star Bulk Carriers, as well as Simos Spreiru and Christos Burglars, co-CFOs, and Konstantinos Simantiras, who is the head of research, and will talk to us about the dry bulk market conditions. We're going to talk about the overall market as well as Star Bulk's positioning and how they can benefit in the current environment. Before we begin, a disclosure, nothing on the call today constitutes official investment advice or company guidance in any form. Good morning, gentlemen, or good afternoon to you, depending on where you're at. Welcome, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Jay. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. Good to have you on the line. Right off the bat, let's talk about the current market balance for dry bulk. Right now, we've seen a lot of volatility in Capesize markets. We've seen those rates pulling back a little bit. We've seen a little bit more steadiness in the midsize market over the past year. What are some of the dynamics driving that, and what factors should investors be really paying attention to?
Sure. Well, I think that question is probably right for Konstantinos Simantiras, our head of market research. Konstantine.
Yeah, thank you, Hamish. Well, Jay, the current market balance is tight and should be expected to tighten even further during the next couple of quarters. Main reason is the supply picture, which is extremely positive. We have deliveries slowing down. Steaming speeds are experiencing strong downward pressures as a result of the record high bunker costs. For example, VLSFO prices today have reached $1,200 in Singapore. This is record high levels, and it's creating huge downward pressures for steaming speeds. Then there's a strong increase in congestion during the last 9 months, during the first month of this year, it has especially on the smaller sizes. And you're right that the Capesize have indeed experienced volatility as of late. On the demand side, we have gone through a very difficult first half with various negative factors. We had the Indonesian ban, we had a war, but now we are entering the strong seasonal season for exports, and China appears to be finally reopening. I think like primary factors, as you mentioned, focus is probably the iron ore trade, which has underperformed during the first half of this year. But I mean, especially if we focus on Chinese imports of iron ore and Brazil exports. Brazil exports during the first quarter declined by approximately 10% year on year. And we expect that a recovery, a strong rebound is about to take place during the second half of this year with a very positive effect on ton miles.
Yeah, it's certainly something we've been watching really closely. And of course, we're also looking at where spot rates are at versus the forward freight agreements, the FFA markets. And 2 months ago, it was pretty clear we were in heavy contango, which was suggesting, of course, that the futures were more optimistic and spot rates would climb. And we saw that. But then about 2 weeks ago, it flipped and it flipped into more of a backwardation scenario where the FFAs were lower. And you know, we've seen all sorts of volatility in FFAs. And right now, you know, today and of course, the last week, they've been significantly lower. What do you think the driver of that is? Is this all kind of China, Brazil flows, or is there something else going on there?
Well, you know, when we focus on the Cape market is extremely volatile. actually exports of iron ore from Brazil and Australia during the last few months have underperformed. And at the same time, there was a short-term increase of in VLOC arrivals. So the utilization of Capes goes up and down very, very quickly. But as mentioned before, the strong seasonal part is upon us. I mean, exports of Brazilian iron ore increase significantly during the third quarter of this of every year, and we are in this transition period.
Yeah, and keep in mind that we've had a very weak iron ore movement, and yet rates have been as good as they have been. It tells you that the market is very close to balance.
Yeah. Plus, Jay, I mentioned that congestion is very high, especially for the smaller sizes. But the Chinese congestion of Capes during the last 2 months has decreased because of less arrivals. So there was, a short-term influx of vessels, which might have helped explain this correction. The good thing is that we're seeing very strong positive signs from the Chinese steel industry, and this is one of the things that we are anticipating and looking forward to.
Yeah, there's definitely some reasons for optimism on the China side, but of course there's also reasons to be concerned, pessimistic. The zero COVID policies have been dragging on. Chinese economic data has been pretty weak, pretty mixed. Do you see China more as, it sounds like you're optimistic, but do you see it more as a tailwind, as something to look forward to later this year, or are you concerned that China could be more of a headwind?
You're right. There's definitely risk with China with their zero COVID policy, but the latest indicators are very encouraging, and we expect it to be a reopening tailwind, I would say. I mean, focusing on especially on the dry bulk factors, the steel production during the last few weeks has finally rebounded, into year-over-year growth. There's also less scrap consumed in the steelmaking process, and their iron ore stockpiles have been declining substantially during the last 2 months. So all these are really good fundamental indicators that a strong recovery of imports is about to take place.
Yeah, and also, again, in the same vein, keep in mind that we've had the rates we've had while much of China has been locked down. And now, it's only getting better. And of course, stimulating the Chinese economy has been done, by the Chinese government through basically real estate and infrastructure, which indirectly is subsidizing the steel production.
Yeah.
So, it's all good.
Yeah, Hamish makes a really good point. I mean, during the last 9 months, China has gone through a mini recession. I mean, during the second half of last year, steel production was down by almost 20% year on year, and the rates that and the market has been able to keep very profitable rates under this environment.
Yeah, so China is, we think, basically upside from here.
Yeah, well, I hope you're right. And I know it's definitely been a headwind so far. That much is clear.
Right.
Yeah. The mid-sized markets, I mean, they've been much more strong and stable the last couple of years. I mean, the Ukraine is thrown a wrench in that equation a little bit. When you look at the impact of the disruption in Ukraine and what it might do to grains and coal and some of the other minor bulks coming out of there, do you think that's going to be a negative on ton miles and a negative for midsize, or is it more of a mixed or nuanced or positive because of the rerouting? What do you think about that?
Well, Jane, you're right. I think it is a mix of positive and negative factors, but they're likely to have a net positive effect. I mean, volumes will, out of Ukraine and Russia, will be affected over the next quarters. Especially, I mean, Ukraine grain exports are approximately 10% of global grain trade. But as you correctly point out, we expect an increase in ton miles, especially for coal and steel products, and this will more than mitigate. And there are other reasons to be optimistic. I mean, the strong increase in gas prices has revived the coal trade for the next few years at least. And at the same time, the strong increase in oil prices and bunker prices is creating an indirect positive effect through lower speeds, and it's constraining supply, incentivizing slow steaming. So there are some negatives in terms of volumes, but I think that we will gradually, the market will, in the medium term, will gradually feel a net positive effect.
Yeah, again, one of those ones where I hope you're right. I'm following closely. I mean, it depends on who you talk to, right? I mean, I know there's going to definitely be some ton mile additions because of rerouting, but there's also a concern of when do those grains come back online and what happens there. Sounds like mixed, but a little bit net positive. And it sounds like Capes, you're basically all positive on those.
Yeah, pretty much. You summed it up really nicely.
Okay. One of the questions I was going to ask, and it sounds like I've kind of gotten the answer already, but we talked 6 months ago in January. We talked about the dry bulk markets, and you were very bullish and constructive on the market back then. How do your views today? A lot has happened. This is unusual. A lot has happened in 5 months since we last talked. Are you more bullish today, less bullish, about the same? How do you view yourselves versus last January?
Well, you know, as you said, a lot has happened. We are definitely more bullish on the supply side. There's no ordering taking place. The order book continues to be at record close to record lows, despite the very healthy freight environment. This is amazing, and with the environmental regulations are coming closer. But at the same time, we've had a war during these 6 months. A war began, and this has actually further improve the supply picture, in our opinion. So we are definitely more bullish, and especially for the next 6 months, as we are just entering the seasonal strong part for trade, and China appears to be finally recovering.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on, and things that people could interpret it negatively or positively, depending on your framework. One thing that's gone on that I think is clearly positive, at least for your net asset valuation, is we've seen new build prices rise significantly, right? For the resales and the new builds, yard slots are not even available right now for a while. We've also seen demolition values rise up on the other end of the curve. So we got this NAV curve that's getting lifted like a V-shape or U-shape, however you want to call it. Is this sustainable, the very high demolition prices and the very high new build prices, or are things getting a little bit stretched here?
Well, you know, Jay, it's extremely difficult to make predictions on asset values and on how high they can get. Having said that, I mean, the shipbuilding costs have risen substantially during the last one and a half year. And there are clearly capacity constraints for the next several years. And this will support new building prices. And on the demo side, on the other end, demolition values have increased, and steel price fundamentals for the short and medium term look very strong. And actually, the Ukraine war further strengthened upside potential for steel prices.
Yeah, and I should point out also that, you know, you may think new building prices are high now, but I think we really haven't seen anything, you know, compared to the prices that are going to be the rule for example, ammonia fuel new buildings, which would be the one of the likely zero carbon fuels that will have to be used by ships in the relatively near future. Basically refreshing the fleet in order to use, sophisticated zero carbon or low carbon technology is going to basically happen as a result of very high rates, you know, over the next decade. So, yeah, these new buildings that are going to be required by the environmental regs aren't going to construct themselves. You know, ship owners are going to have to be financially incentivized to order these ships because of very high rates. Those high rates are going to come because the 10% of the fleet that is most fuel inefficient is going essentially to be regulated out of existence, and probably on an ongoing basis, and you know, supporting rates for quite a long time.
Yeah, I can certainly see some of the dynamics on the new build side that suggest, all right, the cost of inputs, the tight yard capacity, that suggests those prices certainly make sense. What about the demolition values? I mean, they're pushing, you know, $700 per light deadweight ton, plus or minus. Normally, mid-cycle is like $350. We're double that right now. Are there concerns on that side of the curve that things are getting a little out of control?
Well, I don't think that there are actually concerns. I mean, the scrap availability has definitely decreased because most markets are healthy, so there's not a lot of demolition taking place. But at the same time, the steel mills are using less scrap. And despite that, the prices reached really high levels during the last 3 months. I would say that as the steel dynamics return over the next 6 months, with China coming back and perhaps creating somewhat higher iron ore prices, we will see support also on scrap prices. There is a correlation between the two. Okay, $700 is it's definitely a very high number, but it could go higher. I mean, especially when we compare to with the behavior of various other commodities during the last 1 year.
And also, I think that the focus on net asset value is probably, you know, not really as relevant as maybe it used to be. I mean, at this point, you know, given the efficiencies we've managed to introduce into our operations, we are, you know, managing ships with, you know, operating expense and overhead something like $1,600 a day, lower than our peer group. And the time charter equivalents that we've been earning, you know, when you analyze it on a vessel by vessel class basis, compared to our peers, and I believe we use a service called Vessel Index to do that, you know, are something like 4,000 a day greater than the average of our peers, you know, and you add that up and, you know, that's over $5,000 a day more earnings per vessel than the average of our peers. And, you know, that is a huge impact on the value of the ships in our hands as opposed to the value of the ships in other people's hands. So, you know, when you combine that with our dividend policy, you know, I think net asset value is becoming less relevant.
Yeah, well, you're definitely making the point, Hamish. One of the questions, of course, I always ask is why pick Starbulk over peers? And so you're beating me to that punch. Definitely tracking your outperformance and some of the lower G&A numbers and things like that. Just to kind of wrap up the current bane we were at on asset prices, I did want to ask, looking at the new builds, I know that's something that, you know, Starbulk hasn't recently considered and whatnot, but if you were considering new builds, when are yard slots available? Can you still get some stuff for 24? Are we talking 2025? What's that look like?
Well, I had a discussion this morning with our S&P department about that, and I understand that there's still some but limited capacity for 2024, and it's mainly for smaller sized vessels, like Kamsarmaxes, Ultramaxes. Well, larger sizes, you probably have to go into 2025.
Wow. Yeah. So significantly pushed back and at a time, of course, when the order book is basically record low. So that's.
Yeah. But well, the containers are taking up capacity. I mean, there has been a very strong shipbuilding boom there.
Yeah. Containers, car carriers, LNG, lots of stuff going on there, especially, I guess, for the bigger slots, right? The bigger size ships. What about scrubber spreads? I mean, you moved early. You got the whole fleet basically with scrubbers installed. I'm seeing, depending on what market you're in, there's anywhere from $200 a ton to $500 a ton of scrubber spread. Can you talk to me a little bit about that? Or what sort of differentials are you seeing? And are you locking any of that in, or are you just letting it kind of float at this point?
Well, today, the scrubber spread in Singapore was quoted at $535 per ton. It's huge. However, the forward curve is heavily discounted. I mean, the second half is slightly above $250, 2023 slightly above $150. And as you pointed out, I mean, we have the competitive advantage of installing scrubbers early and at a relatively low cost. and we have now almost fully repaid this investment. So this allows us actually to be more aggressive and enjoy what's happening in the spot market and not have to accept strong discounts.
Highlighting this point, because essentially we have now repaid the entire investment of scrubbers plus of hire that we incurred in order to install scrubbers, which comes to approximately 250 million. And having repaid the entire investment, we are in a good position to basically enjoy the high spot market in the spread. Of course, should we see high levels and the discount to spot being lower in the next few months, we may hedge forward the position as we have done in the past.
Yeah, a large part of the reason for the high scrubber spread is the shortage of vacuum gas oil coming out of Russia. And, you know, it doesn't look to us like that's coming back anytime soon, which is one of the reasons we have not hedged.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Normally, you know, a little bit of a market call, but I think one that certainly has some logic behind it. So, I mean, that's obviously contributing a lot on a per dollar, per day basis on your fleet. I mean, higher than probably you even thought. Just some round numbers for folks. What's that look like for a Capesize or Newcastle, one of the larger vessels versus one of your smaller vessels? What sort of dollar a day?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, if you think a Cape is burning on average sort of 40 tons a day, you know, it's 40 times, you know, 500 if you recently bunkered in Singapore, and it's 40 times sort of 300 if you recently bunkered in Rotterdam. But, you know, I think a better way to look at it is that we burn about 700,000 tons of fuel a year, and take the average scrubber spread over the year and multiply by roughly 700,000 tons, and that's how much we'll earn. So at $200 a ton, for example, that's $140 million.
Yeah, we're talking significant boosts to your earnings. And it's 100% free cash flow at that point. So yeah, certainly.
Correct.
Certainly fantastic. It sounds like you're not really wanting to lock that in and hedge it yet because of the very, very steep backwardation on the spread. But if that would change a little bit, you'd be willing to lock it in.
Yeah, it's the steep backwardation, and you know, frankly, the paper market doesn't seem to be representative of the actual spreads we're really getting, which are high, because we do tend to bunker more in Singapore.
Okay. Yeah. No. Very, very interesting factor, and I'm not sure how much a lot of, you know, the market's really picking up on that. Obviously, shipping people know about it, but I don't know how much that is getting accounted for, right, in value. You mentioned NAV as, you know, having its flaws, and, you know, obviously this is a case where not all ships are created equal. One point you made on management, of course, but on another point, little specifications, like whether or not a ship has a scrubber could be worth millions of dollars.
Yeah, exactly.
So what about the capital allocation priorities and the balance sheet going forward? You've pivoted to a model where you're paying out almost all your free cash flow. Is there any likelihood for that to change, or are you sticking with that plan? And anything on the debt side, do you want to move on?
Well, we're paying out all of our free cash flow after paying down $200 million of debt. You know, what we define as free cash flow is free cash flow after, you know, a very substantial debt repayment every year. And, you know, at that rate, you know, we bring our debt down, our net debt, you know, gets down to zero in, I think, under 5 years. You know, so it's not bad. You know, look, our strategy is to protect the dividend. The dividend is very important to us. It's very important to our board members. You know, we think it's very important to our shareholders. And we're not going to do anything to put that dividend in jeopardy. What we do intend to do whenever possible is to use our equity to buy ships in a way that is accretive to the shareholders, you know, accretive to the dividend, accretive to earnings, you know, ideally, you know, reducing the average age of our fleet. you know, but we're not going to do it if it's not, you know, good for the shareholders. You know, but we would intend to bring down leverage over time by doing accretive acquisitions with shares, you know, to buy ships with less debt than we've got right now. You know, we do intend to bring our leverage as a percentage of assets down, you know, over time, you know, as low as possible, but yeah, not by putting the dividend at risk.
Okay, Amish, yeah, that's useful, very helpful.
What we're also doing is that we're trying to optimize in every way possible the cost of our senior debt, which is already quite competitively priced, but we are taking advantage of the fact that there is demand from financial institutions to provide new senior debt to big companies like ourselves. And therefore, where possible, we're refinancing debt that was previously priced at LIBOR plus in the high 2s or 3% with new debt that is priced at SOFR, which is the replacement of LIBOR, plus 1.6 to 1.8%, thereby saving more than a percentage point on the debt, which corresponds, which will correspond to annual savings of about $5 million per year.
Yeah, that makes sense. As your leverage comes down and the balance sheet gets stronger, you're able to get a little bit better terms there on the spreads. You know, if you were going to go out in the market, and I know you said potentially, right, you're not committing to anything, but if you were going to go out there and buy some ships, ships for shares or use cash to buy ships, however it might be, what sort of vessels are you the most interested in? What sort of age range, what sort of size?
You know, look, we like our fleet. So we would if we you know saw an opportunity to accretively acquire a fleet, if it looked like our current fleet in terms of size distributions, that would be ideal. And you know I think what we would pay attention to is fuel efficiency. We would pay some attention to age. You know, we'd like to make acquisitions that will reduce the average age of our fleet, but you know, with secondhand ships, not with new buildings. And, you know, ships of a few years old, you know, are fine. You know, 5 to 10 year old ships, that would be great.
Yeah. I think first generation eco vessels, around 7 year old vessels, are great for renewal purposes.
With scrubbers, of course.
Yeah.
That would be optimal, right? If we can get them with scrubbers. If we can't get them with scrubbers, we'll take that into account on the price. And, you know, obviously we know a lot about how to install scrubbers when that makes sense.
Yeah, certainly. It's not, you're not stuck with whatever it is. So to that end, and to the efficient management of your shares and your balance sheet and all that, you did something really interesting last quarter. And you know, I was, as an investor, prior investor, analyst, I was a big fan. I, you know, sent you a note congratulating you, but you basically issued shares, and this is my calculation, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you basically issued shares about 110% NAV, and you repurchased shares in the same quarter about 90% NAV. So you're basically just arbitraging both sides of that market.
This was not, you know, this was good. It wasn't as good as what we had intended to do, but you know, when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. We had identified a really attractive arbitrage transaction. We issued shares under the ATM to try to do that basically very, very attractive transaction involving vessels. And then, you know, before we had issued too many shares under the ATM, a couple of things happened. One was that the arbitrage transaction we had identified, you know, receded a little bit into the distance. And at the same time, our shares dropped. And we said, you know what? We you know, have issued some shares. We know that the shareholders don't want us to issue shares unless we have a good use for the proceeds. The use of proceeds we had identified is receding a little bit from our grasp, but our share price has dropped, so we can use that money that we've raised right away to buy shares back cheaper than we issued. So we did that. And, you know, it resulted in a good outcome for everybody, not quite as good as we had hoped for, but, you know, we did what we could for the shareholders.
Yeah, that certainly makes sense. So it sounds like you can never complain, obviously, about repurchasing your shares at a big discount to NAV, right? That's obviously accretive and it's going on in the market. But it sounds like the 110% issuance was asset tied. If you didn't have assets identified, you wouldn't necessarily be selling at just 110. You'd wait for a higher premium.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Because that was one of my follow-ups there, or related questions is, you know, I love it. I love the arbitrage, but why not do, you know, something looser, like, you know, 80% repurchase?
And well, we don't intend to issue shares without having something to do with the money.
What about for like debt repayment or accelerated something?
We do not currently intend to issue shares to repay debt.
Okay, now that's clear. It's a follow up I needed to make. Looking at your current NAV, and I know obviously, you know, NAVs can be debatable based on what broker you're using and all sort of that stuff, or if you include working capital and if you include pro forma cash flows and all that sort of stuff. But even after you pay this big dividend, I have your NAV right now trailing numbers around 30. And if I include pro forma Q2 cash flows, scrubber spreads, eco premiums, all that, you're definitely lower to mid 30s. We're in the middle of a big shipping sell-off this morning. So I'm just curious, is that repurchase open for business, or is that only if you've done some sort of arbitrage?
You know, we have a share repurchase program authorized. There's room left under it. We do not generally intend to repurchase shares using cash that could otherwise be paid out as a dividend. If we repurchase shares normally, it would be funded by sales of vessels. You know, but, you know, we're probably, you know, not going to put the dividend at risk with a share repurchase.
Okay. So if you saw a big discount to NAV, I mean, today it's probably, again, debatable who you ask, but as we're talking today, the morning of June 8th, it's debatably between a 10 and 20% discount to pro forma NAV. So if that discount gets any wider, it sounds like what you would do is, first, step one, you would contact an interested party and see if they want to buy a ship at current or above market value. And then once that contract is signed and agreed, then you would repurchase. Is that fair?
Well, that's certainly one way it could happen. I wouldn't restrict ourselves quite that narrowly, but we're not going to put the dividend at risk.
Okay. That's it. No, it's good to know a lot of folks prioritize the dividend. I think at a discount to NAV, I think, you know, hell with the dividend, buy the shares. But I mean, I know that's a debate that investors have different views on. These are great. I'm going to look to some of the questions folks have posted in the chat and try to incorporate those in as well. In the meantime, as I do that, I want to give you a chance, Hamish, and the rest of the team to circle back. What differentiates Star Bulk Carriers? There's so many dry bulk companies. There's like 10 of them. What differentiates you? I know you hinted at it earlier. You said, look, we're outperforming the indices. What else differentiates Star Bulk Carriers? Why should investors pick you over somebody else?
Well, look, I think a few things differentiate us. I think maybe one of the most important things that differentiates us from some of our peers is our, you know, corporate governance. We take corporate governance very seriously. We have a very strong board of directors. We have three members from Oaktree. We have, another institutional investor. We have two ship owners, and for a Greek company to have a Norwegian ship owner and an Italian ship owner, both of whom ended up on the board because they sold their fleets to Star and took back shares, is a real endorsement of our corporate governance. We have a compensation committee that takes its job very seriously in terms of compensating management when shareholders make money. You know, and as a result, we think and act like shareholders. We are, as management, shareholders. We work for the shareholders, and, you know, it's as a result of that, that we've gotten our operating costs to the lowest in the industry, our overheads per ship per day to the lowest in the industry, and, you know, our revenues per ship are substantially above our peer group. So, you know, our view is that ships in our hands are worth substantially more than ships that are in others' hands. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why we frankly pay less attention to NAV than you know, to many other metrics.
Thanks for that. Yeah.
And just to add to what Haney said, it's maybe worth mentioning our focus on ESG. ESG is at the very top of our agenda. We actually have three axes of as far as our short to medium term strategy is concerned. On the first axis, we are investing in research and development. As we have announced recently, we have cooperated with some big players in our industry like Cargill, Rio Tinto, and Oldendorf to basically cooperate in the so-called Green Corridors Initiative, where we aim to have vessels that have zero carbon footprint operating between Australia and China to create a green corridor where vessels will not be emitting CO2, and the way that the fuel will be produced will be also carbon neutral. We're also participating in other projects. We're closely following carbon capture. And then the second axis has to do with basically improving the consumption of our existing vessels. We're installing energy-saving devices on some of our vessels with a view to optimizing consumption and therefore reducing our carbon footprint on those vessels. And thirdly, we're also optimizing the way we execute each voyage. We have a vessel performance monitoring department that takes into account the various parameters of the charter party, the weather, and the conditions that the vessels operate in order to basically come up with the optimal speed with a view to reducing the consumption and therefore reducing our carbon footprint.
Yeah, thank you, Christos. I think that's an excellent compliment to Hamish's points on the corporate governance and the efficiency of operations, is that you can also argue an efficiency and an ESG angle there as well. And that's an excellent segue into one of the final questions I wanted to ask. And I know it's a little preliminary, but there's a lot we can do with the on-the-water fleet. We can do the optimization stuff you talked about. We've talked about slow steaming in the past. The carbon intensity initiatives and EEXI are going to start coming into play starting next year. What about on the new build front / new propulsion technologies? Is there anything in the last, you know, 6 to 12 months that looks promising? Ammonia, methanol dual fuel, LNG dual fuel. What's kind of the state at this point?
Well, you know, some people are going with ammonia. Well, some people are intending to go with ammonia. You can't order an ammonia-based engine yet. Some people are going with methanol or LNG, and of course you can order engines to burn methanol or LNG. Getting carbon neutral methanol or carbon neutral LNG is much more complex than getting carbon neutral ammonia. It's a very complex debate as to which might be the more appropriate fuel. In the meantime, there has been some technological progress in carbon capture. We're looking into that quite closely. And of course, if you put carbon capture equipment on board, you can use a fuel oil engine mitigate the carbon emissions that way. You know, I don't know if somebody is going to want to build a new building with just a fuel oil engine and carbon capture equipment, but maybe. You know, we certainly haven't made any decisions yet. The carbon capture equipment that's being trialed now probably won't be commercially available for a couple of years.
So not commercially viable at this point, but something that you are considering and kind of studying, I guess, the economics of it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting. I think with, you know, the correct, or I don't know what, I don't want to use the word correct, but with a high enough tax regime, I can certainly see where something like that might make sense economically. Kind of last question for you, and it's, we're circling back a little bit here, but you have a major shareholder, Oaktree, of course, and they've been very supportive of you know, your dividend policies and your scrubber program and all those sort of things. You know, private equity is usually not known for being permanent investors. Is there any concern about the overhang there? Anything that could be worked out? I mean, I don't know how much you could even comment on that, but is there any appetite, like a tender offer or something like that?
A tender offer? Well, I mean, we're certainly not going to make a tender offer, you know, that would allow Oaktree to sell their stock. You know, that would, I think any tender offer that allowed Oaktree to sell their whole block would basically allow anybody else to sell their whole block, and it would be, you know, we'd have to tender for essentially all of our shares. No, look, I think Oaktree has been a very supportive shareholder. Someday they're going to be a seller. You know, they've shown, you know, a substantial concern for making sure that they don't sell in such a way that the share price is very negatively affected. And, you know, I think over time they'll figure out how to get out. You know, we trade $100 million a day, more or less. So in something like, you know, 35 or 40 trading days, we trade our whole market cap. Oaktree is 25% of our market cap. You know, if they got out of their position over a year, I don't think anybody would notice.
Yeah, that's a good point, Hamish. I think one of the concerns, and I don't know how heavy of a concern it is, but I think, you know, anytime you look at a large private equity holder, kind of an overhang is factored in there, and people just curious, right, how that would work. You bring a good point on the liquidity. All right. Well, thank you, Hamish and Christos and Spiro, the co-CFOs, and Constantinos today. Excellent market commentary, and I always appreciate it when you join our program. And thanks again for your time, gentlemen.
Thanks very much, Jay.
Thank you for hosting us. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
You're very welcome. Until next time. Another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. We are recording on the morning of June 8th, 2022. We just hosted Star Bulk Carriers and their management team to talk about the dry bulk markets and how Star Bulk specifically is positioning themselves there. As a reminder, nothing on the call today constitutes official company guidance or investment recommendations of any form.